Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, we have full coverage of Pope Benedict's pastoral visit this weekend to the Italian cities of Venice and Aquileia in the northeast. Listen to reports from our correspondent on the scene, and a leading member of the Venice in Peril charity talks about their restoration work and how she sees Venice's future. And Jill Bevilacqua looks at this Sunday's Gospel reading. In her programme, there's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye. Benedict has invoked the historic role of the city of Venice as a bridge between East and West, and has urged Italians to welcome immigrants fleeing to their shores. The Pope's appeal came during his homily at an open-air mass celebrated on the Venetian mainland during his weekend pastoral visit to northeastern Italy that earlier took him to the town of Aquileia. Sunday's mass, celebrated in a park before a crowd of over 300,000 faithful, was the spiritual highlight of the Pope's pastoral visit to the region. And our correspondent with the Pope is Chris Altieri, who filed this report.
The Master of Ceremonies, who oversaw the completion of the sanctuary for the Papal Mass, Don Gianandrea di Donna of the Diocese of Padua, told me that preparations were painstaking and extensive.
We have arranged the liturgy many months ago, and so we have the cooperation of many priests and seminarists for the service.
He also described the significance of the elements the designers incorporated into the Byzantine-style decoration of the great gilt apse they had constructed.
We would like to have like a basilica behind the sky, you see. And so we have the catino absidale with Jesus Christ, daisies, with Mary, Holy Mary, yes. And Saint Mark, the evangelist. Behind the apostles, and behind Christ, the Pope, that is the sign of Christ in the church, and the bishops behind the apostles.
In his homily, Pope Benedict returned to what emerged from the very beginning of his public remarks as the central theme of this visit to northeastern Italy, the integral role of the church in public life, commerce, and culture.
È significativo che il luogo prescelto per questa liturgia sia il Parco di San Giuliano.
It is significant, said Pope Benedict, that the place chosen for this liturgy is the Parco San Giuliano, a place where you usually do not celebrate religious rituals, but cultural and musical events. And he went on to say that on this Sunday, this space is host to the risen Jesus, truly present in his word, in the people of God with their pastors, and preeminently in the sacrament of his body and blood. To be in the world, though not of it, this tension is perennially present in the life of the Church. It was a tension the Holy Father addressed in his remarks at the Regina Caeli after Sunday Mass in Parco San Giuliano, this time in a prayerful and a Marian key.
Il Signore conceda a voi, abitanti di queste terre, ricche di una lunga storia cristiana.
The Lord grant the people of this land, he prayed, long blessed with a rich Christian history, to live the gospel after the model of the early church, in which the multitude of those who came to faith had one heart and one soul. The Pope invoked the Blessed Virgin Mary, asking her to sustain the apostolic labors of priests, to make fruitful the testimony of men and women religious, enliven the daily work of parents in the first transmission of the faith to their children. light the way for young people so that they might walk confidently on the path traced by the faith of their fathers. Fill the hearts of the elderly with hope. Be near and comfort the sick and suffering, and strengthen the work of the many lay people who are active in the new evangelization in parishes. Finally, he encouraged everyone to work with the true spirit of communion in the world, which he described as the great vineyard in which the Lord has called us to labor. In Venice with the Holy Father, I'm Chris Altieri.
The Mass was followed by the praying of the Regina Coeli. Afterwards, the Pope returned in a motorboat to the historic centre of Venice, where he lunched with bishops of the Patriarchate. Later on Sunday, Pope Benedict was due to address an assembly of bishops at St. Mark's Basilica for the closure of the diocesan pastoral visit. And then, like so many visitors before him, Pope Benedict was scheduled to take a gondola ride from St. Mark's Square along the Grand Canal of the Lagoon City. It was the very same gondola which his predecessor, Blessed John Paul II, used during his visit to Venice in 1985. Pope Benedict was being taken by the gondola across the mouth of the Grand Canal to the Basilica della Salute, where he was due to give an address to political, business and cultural leaders. His final engagements in Venice were to bless the Patriarchate's recently restored Chapel of the Blessed Trinity and inaugurate the library of the Studium Generale Marcianum, a church-sponsored academic and research foundation, before flying back to Rome. Pope Benedict's first stop in northeastern Italy on Saturday afternoon was a visit to the ancient town of Aquileia, which was once one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire. Here he addressed a preparatory assembly for the Ecclesial Congress of Aquileia, which is due to be held at Pentecost in 2012. In the late afternoon, Pope Benedict flew by helicopter to Venice and was taken by boat to the historical centre, where he was greeted by over 20,000 faithful packed into St. Mark's Square. Chris Altieri reports on his arrival and his address to the people of Venice.
The sun was rapidly setting as Pope Benedict XVI approached the pier at St. Mark's Square in Venice Saturday evening, where he greeted the city fathers and the faithful before going into the Basilica of St. Mark for private, prayerful recollection and veneration of the evangelist's relics, which have been conserved in the basilica for more than 1,000 years. All the way in, shouts went up from the square, barges blasted their water cannon, and church bells pealed their sonorous salute to Peter as the Lion of St. Mark danced in the seaward breeze. After his landing and reception by the civil authorities of the city, the region, and the Italian Republic, there was a brief tour of the piazza where thousands of Venetians were on hand to greet His Holiness. And then Pope Benedict climbed the stair and took his place on the richly carpeted raised red dais. As they had that afternoon in Aquileia, Pope Benedict's evening remarks in Venice went beyond the perfunctory exchange of pleasantries that these encounters always have, though in Venice the perfunctory entails a great deal of pomp and pageantry. Rather, the Holy Father again praised the past glory of La Serenissima, and challenged this Venetian generation to be the equals and even the betters of their forebears.
Tale patrimonio di tradizioni civili, culturali.
This patrimony of civil traditions, culture, and art, said Pope Benedict, found rich development thanks also to Venetians' embrace of the Christian faith, the power of the faith to inform and perfect the culture in which and to which it is proclaimed. This has been a constant refrain of Pope Benedict's whole pontificate, and it has been a central theme of this visit to northeastern Italy. So prayed Pope Benedict, "As I visit your city, I ask the Lord to give you all a sincere and fruitful faith, a faith that can nourish both great hope and the patient search for the common good." With the Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI in Venice, I'm Chris Altieri.
Widely considered one of the most beautiful and romantic cities in the world, Venice is a World Heritage City, jammed with historical monuments and works of art that are visited by over 20 million tourists each year. But it's also a city that is sinking and faced with rising sea levels, which means that it gets flooded more and more frequently. Lady Frances Clark is a member of the executive committee of the UK-based Venice in Peril charity, operating under the auspices of UNESCO to raise funds for the preservation of historical monuments, churches and works of art in the Lagoon City. She talked to our correspondent Chris Altieri about the restoration work they do and about what kind of future Venice has.
We were called in by the Italian government, stimulated international interest in after the floods of 66. There are many others, like, say, Venice Inc., American, Venetian Heritage. The English started their operations right back in 68, restoring or beginning the restoration or conservation of a church called the Madonna dell'Orto, which is on the north side of Venice, which was a church much praised by Ruskin. So this had quite a significance for the English. And then the next church we did on the same sort of principle was down here in Dorsoduro, close to the maritime station, San Niccolò dei Mendicoli, another very ancient church, probably in origin 600 and something. And again, it's become a place for people to search out. And gradually, over the years, we've done more and more.
The city is a city that has well over 1,000 years of history. Venice has a past that everyone needs to know about. Does the city have a future?
The thing is that what do you think of as the city of Venice? The city of Venice, for most people, is the lagoon and where we are now, San Marco d'Ossodoro, the Sestiere. But don't forget that two-thirds of the population of Venice are on the other side of the causeway, if you like to call it that, to Mestre. That's where two-thirds of the people live and work. And so you have to think of Venice as a much more of a conglomerate thing than just the picturesque and architectural history and treasures that we think of, and which has been depicted so beautifully by so many painters over the ages. So what is the future of Venice? Unfortunately, it is more and more tourism. It used to have quite a big, thriving industrial area at Marghera, but that, because of the reasons of pollution, has been closed down. And so there are always problems with the workforce finding alternative work.
That was Lady Frances Clark of the Venice in Peril charity, talking to Chris Altieri. And you can hear more on the final stages of Pope Benedict's visit to Venice on our programme tomorrow, and also by checking out our webpage on vaticanradio.org/English. And now, Jill Bevilacqua looks at this Sunday's Gospel reading in her programme, There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
Two disciples of Jesus that same day, the first day of the Sabbath, were making their way to a village named Emmaus, 7 miles distant from Jerusalem, discussing as they went all that had happened. In the course of their lively exchange, Jesus approached and began to walk along with them. However, they were restrained from recognizing him. He said to them, "What are you discussing as you go your way?" They halted in distress, and one of them, Cleopas by name, asked him, "Are you the only resident in Jerusalem who does not know the things that went on there these past few days?" He said to them, "What things?" They said, "All those that had to do with Jesus of Nazareth, a prophet powerful in word and deed in the eyes of God and all the people, how our chief priests and elders delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. We were hoping that he was the one who would set Israel free. Besides all this, today, the third day since these things happened, some women of our group have just brought us some astonishing news. They were at the tomb before dawn and failed to find his body, but returned with the tale that they had seen a vision of angels who declared he was alive. Some of our number went to the tomb and found it to be just as the women said, but him they did not see. Then he said to them, "What little sense you have! How slow you are to believe all that the prophets have announced! Did not the Messiah have to undergo all this so as to enter into his glory? Beginning then with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them every passage of Scripture which referred to him. By now they were near the village to which they were going, and he acted as if he were going farther, but they pressed him, 'Stay with us. It's nearly evening. The day is practically over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he'd seated himself with them to eat, he took bread, pronounced the blessing, then broke the bread and began to distribute it to them. With that, their eyes were opened and they recognized him, whereupon he vanished from their sight. They said to one another, 'Were not our hearts burning inside us as he talked to us on the road and explained the scriptures to us?' They got up immediately and returned to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 and the rest of the company assembled. They were greeted with, 'The Lord has been raised. It is true, he has appeared to Simon.' Then they recounted what had happened on the road and how they had come to know him in the breaking of the bread."
It's not at all unusual for someone who's totally alien to our culture to bring out one of its characteristics which never seemed particularly important to us, and by so doing offers a new, surprising perspective. Back in the 1960s, a Marxist film director was resting in his hotel and, having brought nothing to read with him, picked up the book that was lying on the bedside table and began idly to turn the pages. Within moments, he was riveted and only put the book down when he had read the last page. Its title? The Gospel According to St. Matthew. And when the film came out, that was what it was called. What struck me when I saw it, and what has remained with me, was its extraordinary onward movement. Not something we usually connect with the Gospels, possibly because we rarely read them from start to finish in a sitting. A frequent shot in the film was of Jesus walking, and it came home to me that in fact our Lord spent the 3 years of his public life walking, walking, walking. The only recorded incident when he rides is that of Palm Sunday, on his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. But for readers of the Gospels in past centuries, there would have been nothing strange in this. Apart from the rich and the mighty, people walked, sometimes great distances, and thought nothing of it. On the first Easter Sunday, we're told, two disciples of Jesus were making their way to a village named Emmaus, 7 miles distant from Jerusalem. When they recognized Jesus in the breaking of bread and he vanished from their sight, what did they do? They got up immediately and returned to Jerusalem. And this despite the fact that it was now evening, if not night. But they must have walked at a very different speed from that outward journey when they were so downcast. And when they were nearly there, did they run like Peter and John, each wanting to be the first with the tremendous news? We don't know. One thing is certain. They seem to have thought nothing of walking 7 miles twice in one day. 2 centuries ago, the poet William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy, who lived in the English Lake District, were joined by their friend, the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. A distance of 13 miles separated their houses. But they visited each other regularly, at times doing the double journey, never turning a hair. One biographer writes,
"Often they started these journeys at dusk or later, arriving at each other's houses about midnight."
Sometimes, though, it was not exactly a walkover, as on one occasion when they were visiting friends and, recounts the biographer,
"They walked in frost, wind and showers of hail, by the exposed road over the moors to Ulswater."
Dorothy herself wrote about it later in her journal.
"December the 29th, Tuesday. A fine morning, a thin fog upon the hills which soon disappeared. The sun shone. We turned out of the road at the second milestone and passed a pretty cluster of houses among tall trees, partly of Scotch fir and some naked forest trees. We crossed a bridge just below these houses, and the river winded sweetly along the meadows. Our road soon led us along the sides of dreary, bare hills, but we had a glorious prospect to the left of Saddleback, halfway covered with snow, and underneath the comfortable white houses and the village of Frelkeld. As we ascended the hills, it grew very cold and slippery. Luckily, the wind was at our backs and helped us on. A sharp hail shower gathered at the head of Martindale, and the view upwards was very grand. The wild cottages seen through the hurrying hail shower. The wind drove and eddied about and about, and the hills looked large and swelling through the storm. The road was often very slippery, the wind high, and it was nearly dark before we got into the right road. I was often obliged to crawl upon all fours.
Today, people go on organised walks and are carefully warned in the introductory brochures of the amount of activity involved. Level 1, up to 3 miles of gentle walking on any one day. And in italics,
no special preparation required, providing you are used to gentle exercise.
Level 2, 3 to 8 miles of brisker walking on any one day, some hill climbs possible. And in italics,
some regular exercise before the course is recommended, especially if you do not walk these distances regularly.
Oh dear, how soft we have become. Some hill climbs must certainly have been possible in the walk between Jerusalem and Emmaus. I have a photograph in front of me of the hills of Emmaus at dusk, and they're substantial hills. And Jerusalem itself is a city set on a hill. One wonders why the two disciples were going to Emmaus. Was it their village, or were they going to tell friends there of the happenings in Jerusalem? Where did they have the meal, in an inn or in a private house? The evangelist doesn't say, concentrating on the essentials. Today, too, we might think it strange if we were walking with a friend and while deep in conversation are interrupted by a stranger who comes up level with us and asks us what we're talking about. But the disciples merely halted in distress, or in other versions, stopped short, their faces downcast, stood still, looking sad. And in their amazement that a man coming from Jerusalem should be unaware of the tragic end of a great prophet, they pour it all out, unburdened their grief and their disillusionment, to say nothing of their astonishment at the news the women had brought. Jesus reproves them for their slowness to believe what the prophets had foretold and explains everything. And when they are nearly at Emmaus and the stranger makes as if he were going further, they invite him to stay with them. It's nearly evening. The day is practically over. This invitation has captured the imagination of people ever since, as indeed has the whole episode of the two going to Emmaus. A verse of one hymn runs like this.
And dimly in the evening light he joined two friends who walked alone, a stranger till he stayed to sup. He brake the bread, and he was known.
The approach of evening often brings with it a feeling of melancholy and the need for a friendly presence, as in another old hymn where the writer cries out to Jesus.
The dying day hath left us lonely, all fadeth from us, thou remain'st only. Earth's light goes out, but thou, true light, art near us, and thou wilt hear us.
Among present-day hymns, one of the most popular is the Italian Resta con noi, Signore, la sera, Stay with us, Lord, in the evening. Years ago, in Lourdes, an English pilgrim asked us for the music. It was for the father of a very sick girl, and as he was the church organist, he wanted to be able to play it for her.
Resta con noi, Signore, la sera.
presented by Jill Bevy Napfer and produced by Sean Patrick Lovell.
Stay with us, Lord, in the evening. Stay with us, Lord, and we will have peace. Stay with us, do not leave us, and night will no longer fall, never fall again. We will bring you our brothers. We will bring them to you along the roads. Stay with us, do not leave us, and night will never fall again. I want to offer you my hands. I want to offer you this heart of mine. Stay with us, do not leave us, and night will no longer fall.
In the 1950s, a French priest, now internationally known as Abbé Pierre, formed a group known as the Companions of Emmaus. His aim was to provide at least a minimum of shelter for hundreds of needy families. With very little monetary aid, he succeeded, later securing the intervention of the French government. Today, the Emmaus movement is worldwide. Here in Italy, the emphasis is on the recuperation of young men in difficulty, who have lost their way. Always, the spirit of Emmaus is present, the welcome, the shelter offered to a stranger. For who knows, the stranger may be Christ himself.
Stay with us, Lord, in the evening, when the shadows descend and darkness falls on the houses, and it is only terror and silence. Each one is alone with night, alone faced with his own solitude, alone with his past and his future, his heart emptied of the time lived. Stay with us, Lord, in the evening. Enter and eat with these lost ones. Keep communion with us, Lord. Without you, every heart is a desert. Now we believe. You are the living one. You are the companion of our journey. We recognize you in the breaking of bread. You give meaning to each one's existence. Now we run once again to the upper room, calling to everyone, we have seen the Lord. Let's make the church new together, a church of men free from all fear. To you, Jesus, O risen one, be every glory. Now rise again in each one of us, because whoever sees you sees the Father, the same Spirit, all over the earth.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, and you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.